from Duke University. His title is Tomija Yausas of Revisit. Please.
Thanks very much. So I want to talk some about the Stramaggeri, Yao, and Zaslow approach to ideas of mirror-symmetry. This is something which started in 96 with their paper. If we start with a Calabi-Yau threefold, so let me just start by kind of reviewing the original argument. You start with a Calabi-Yau threefold Y, and you assume that it has a mirror partner X. So for the original argument and for many of the applications, X and Y should both be compact. There are interesting extensions of some of these ideas to non-compact Calabi-Yaus as well. The original argument went like this. If you look at the D0 brains on the space Y, and you take in particular the ones whose zero brain charge is 1, then those are represented exactly by the points of Y. A zero brain is just corresponding to a point of Y. And one of the stronger forms of the mirror symmetry conjecture, the non-perturbative form of the mirror symmetry conjecture, says that the D0 brains on Y, when you look at the 2A string compactified on Y, should correspond to D3 brains on the mirror X when you look at the 2B theory compactified on X. So there has to be some family of D3 brains on X which corresponds to, whose moduli space corresponds to the points on Y. And this was really the first time that there was an idea for how to get a geometric connection between the two Calabi-Yau manifolds in a mirror pair. Prior to this, throughout the early 90s, we had beautiful constructions, lots of wonderful calculations, a lot of evidence in favor of mirror symmetry, but no kind of geometric underlying idea of what might be behind it. So just to flesh this out a little bit, I remind you that the DP brains have moduli spaces. The moduli spaces really have two parts. There are the geometric moduli, which sort of count the submanifolds of the spaces. And there are also the moduli which describe a bundle, which is on that submanifold. The data for a DP brain consists of a submanifold and a bundle. So typically, for example, in the case of a torus, which is the case that will be relevant to us, you can describe those bundle moduli as H1 of the manifold, the brain divided by, excuse me, H1 real divided by H1 integral. And when you look at the D3 brains on Calabi-Yau threefolds, those that satisfy the BPS condition, one translates that into mathematical terminology. They are the so-called special Lagrangian cycles, whose definition is that the Kähler form should restrict to the manifold, should restrict to zero on the manifold, and for an appropriate holomorphic three form on the Calabi-Yau, the imaginary part of that holomorphic three form should also restrict to zero on the manifold. So the geometric moduli, according to a result of McLean from the very early 90s, has dimension first Betti number when M is a manifold. And so you put that together with the bundle moduli, and you find a total dimension of the moduli space of the D brains, real dimension of 6. Excuse me, we want real dimension 6, so we need the first Betti number to be 3, so that we have 3 geometric moduli and 3 bundle moduli. So the argument then went that Y should have something like a T3 fibration, and that T3 fibration is probably only defined on a subset of Y, mapping to some subset of a parameter space. It should be a collection of supersymmetric cycles, and they should come equipped with bundles in some natural way. Singular fibers should be allowed. And then mirror symmetry proposes that the dual tori should fiber the manifold X. So you can ask questions such as, what are the singular fibers? How does the mirror operation work in detail, given that there have to be singular fibers? What sorts of data is needed to specify the fibration? And I also point out that although the physics argument which led to the derivation of this idea of mirror pairs of torus vibrations was limited to Calabi-Yau threefolds, in fact, you can easily generalize the mathematical idea to Calabi-Yau n-folds and talk about Tn vibrations on Calabi-Yau n-folds. So as most people here know, this is very hard to actually try to carry out any kind of detailed study of these supersymmetric T3 fibrations. In two low-dimensional examples, we have a fair amount of control over what goes on. So one example is the case where X is a two torus. That's a Calabi-Yau one-fold. The parameter space is then a circle, and we can fiber a two torus by circles over a circle. There aren't any singular fibers, and that's the end of the story. The mirror is not so interesting. That you can take the dual torus. It reduces to the phenomenon known in string theory as T-duality very directly with no complications, which are in higher dimensions caused by singular fibers. The next case to look at is the case of K3 surfaces. In this case, we're fortunate because these special Lagrangian manifolds, this is an example of calibrated geometries of Harvey and Lawson, and these special Lagrangian manifolds turn out to be holomorphic submanifolds with respect to another complex structure. So one of the special things about K3 surfaces is that if you fix a Ricci flat metric on a K3 surface, and you just look at it as a Riemannian metric on the K3 surface, there is an entire S2 worth of complex structures which are compatible with that metric, and for which the metric remains Ricci flat. So when you vary the choice of complex structure without changing the metric, you can actually arrive at another metric for which the two tori are holomorphic. And now we can invoke the theory that was worked out in great detail by Kadaira in the early 60s to learn about the possible singular fibers. So Kadaira has a very beautiful classification of singular fibers. All of the main types of singular fibers do occur in torus fibrations on K3 surfaces, although the infinite families only occur with some finite bound because you can't embed a general one in a compact K3. But generically, you have only the simplest type of Kadaira's singularity, what was called I1 in his list, and there are 24 of those. On the torus fibration on an elliptic surface. So I've tried to draw a picture illustrating lots of aspects of this thing. So what we're supposed to imagine is happening to the torus is that the torus itself has a particular cycle on it which shrinks down to a point. So you see a Riemann surface which is acquiring a singularity, and the singular surface is a two-sphere with two points identified. Or another way of, so thinking of this in a family, we can think of that shrinking cycle as being something like a waist of a hyperboloid which is shrinking down to a cone. It's hard to picture these things accurately, and it'll get even worse in a few minutes when I get to higher dimensions. This hyperboloid shrinking down to a cone with the radial parameter drawn in blue there being the deformation parameter that we're looking at. So we have this one complex parameter family of elliptic curves acquiring a singular point. And one of the interesting features topologically about this is that as you go around a circle in the parameter space, the topology of the torus as you traverse the circle is undergoing what's called a Dehn twist. So if you think about building this torus by taking a cylinder and identifying the two ends, you're supposed to twist the two ends before identification according to what the angle that you've gone through as you rotate around the circle in the base. And what that does is by the time you've traversed a complete circle, there's been a twist so that you don't have a topologically trivial family of tori. That twist is important. It forces, for example, the homology class of the shrinking circle to actually shrink at the origin, and that goes some distance to explaining, in a way, why there was a singular point there. If you didn't know what the structure of the singular fiber was, you would be forced to shrink some circle in that homology class down to zero just to preserve the topology of the situation. So the monodromy on the tori was conjugate to 1101, as I was just indicating. The circle, the basis for the first homology of the torus changes by that monodromy transformation as you move around that disk. It's also true that the singular point of the fiber has codimension 4 in the total space. And there's a metric description of it which was found many years ago in the physics literature. It's called the Taubnet metric, so we know locally what the metric looks like. And moreover, when you take M theory on X locally, M theory on this K3 manifold, and you treat that U1 action, the S1, the circle that we're looking at, as the action of a group U1, you mod out by that group action. It has a fixed point now at this singular point of the fibration. And the physics of M theory on that manifold X is the same thing as type 2A on the quotient space X mod U1 with a D6 brain being inserted at the singular point. That's a fairly standard interpretation of the meaning of the 2A 6 brain when lifted to M theory. It's exactly the kind of singularity which is occurring here. So there's been a lot of work on trying to understand the structure, in some sense, of the hypothetical or conjectural Strominger-Yau-Zaslow T3 vibrations in higher dimension. Lots of different assumptions about what it might look like, lots of speculation about the way in which mirror symmetry could be realized, the sorts of things which mirror symmetry might imply about the structure of this vibration. And there have been some back and forth in this business. So, for example, it hasn't been clear, it wasn't clear for a while what the codimension of the singular set was supposed to be. Although there are lots of cases where we have very specific knowledge in examples, for example, of vibrations which topologically behave correctly, we really don't have any concrete examples yet. Nevertheless, I'm today going to propose a slightly new way of looking at the Strominger-Yau-Zaslow vibrations in higher dimension, which I believe is compatible with everything that's been done to date, and which, to my mind, clarifies the situation somewhat. So here's what I'm going to propose as the general structure for the Strominger-Yau-Zaslow vibrations. First of all, we should recognize that, so we have this family of tori parameterized by B with singular fibers allowed, and the focus in many discussions up until this point has been on the discriminant locus of this family, the set of points on the base which are the images of singular fibers. But I would like to focus in addition on the singular set, the set of singular points and fibers themselves, which also maps to the discriminant locus. So in the K3 case that I just discussed, there isn't a whole lot of difference between these two things. We have finite point collections in both cases. But in higher dimensions, it becomes sort of an interesting difference. So the first observation is that S should have real codimension 4, just as it did in the K3 case. And in my wilder moments, I'm willing to speculate that it's, in fact, a complex subvariety. So it would have complex codimension 2 in particular. In real codimension 6 on X, you'll see some singular points of the singular set S, and those singular points should be transverse triple points. So what are transverse triple points? They're hard to draw, and I've been playing some with graphics recently. So what I want to look at is the coordinate axes in C3, Z1, Z2, Z3, right? So those can be thought of as the singular set of the variety where Z1, Z2, Z3 is equal to 0. And so if I were drawing a real picture, you would just see three transverse lines. Of course, I want to try to represent these as Riemann surfaces, since I'm supposing that this may be a complex dimension 1 space. So I've got smooth Riemann surfaces meeting transversely in a single point, three smooth Riemann surfaces meeting transversely in a single point. You need six real dimensions to depict that, and that's hard. So I've been drawing it with sort of points where the intersection point comes. But in my pictures, you should please be aware that the points don't mean that there's a singularity there, that's just indicating where the transfer's business goes. So the next condition is that the image of S and B, that's the image D of S and B, should retract to a trivalent graph gamma. So the trivalent graph structure is one that's been discovered. I should have mentioned some names, pardon me. There's been a lot of work by Gross, by Weidong Ruan, Gross and Siebert, Gross and Wilson, Hasse and Zarkov, a lot of study of these things, all of which I'm really building on here. And the image D of S and B retracts to a trivalent graph gamma. That trivalent graph has two kinds of vertices. So one of the kinds of vertices in the trivalent graph arises from the images of the triple points, my transverse triple points. And that picture is supposed to be three planes in three planes at 120 degree angles to each other, and then within each plane you've got a wedge coming down to a point. That's my proposed image of a transverse triple point. The so-called negative vertices, sorry, I shouldn't say so-called because I'm the one who coined the term, positive and negative. The negative vertices are don't show up in the discriminant locus directly. They're actually come from retractions, but they're retractions of pairs of pants in the graph. And then the thing which originally was used to characterize these two kinds of vertices are monodromy properties. So you see monodromies about loops in the complement of this discriminant locus, and we can represent that in terms of the graph to which it retracts, and there are specific proposed relationships of the monodromies, which go back to work of Gross and Ruan. So I tried to make a picture of one of the components of S. Hello. There it is. I found a new piece of graphic software which I was having fun playing with. It turns out to be not so easy for beginners to use. I wanted to do lots of pictures for this talk, but I only got this one done. So this is a picture of a component of S. Now, it's got all these little points on it. The points are places where it's supposed to meet other components of S. And so on the plane today, I was actually trying to do that, but it really got messed up. So I wanted another one of these, which was meeting along that one of those sets of pointy things, and then another one, because I have to have three groups meeting at the same time. And anyway, that might give you some idea of what the space S, sitting within X, a set of singular points, should look like. All right. So part of the reason for this has to do with an analysis made by Dominic Joyce in the last 2 years about the possibilities for the structure of special Lagrangian fibrations. So there had been a speculation for a while that the discriminant locus of a special Lagrangian fibration should have codimension 2, but Joyce proposed that, in fact, maybe you should say he discovered that generic special Lagrangian fibrations really have a discriminant locus of codimension 1, and he gave an explicit description of the conjectural behavior for this discriminant locus. This explicit description, I've got some probably overly detailed slides telling you something about the explicit description. So in this explicit description, let's see. He modifies an explicit description that had been given by Harvey and Lawson back in the earliest paper on special Lagrangian manifolds. Harvey and Lawson gave a special Lagrangian fibration of C3, which is extremely explicit, and which has a T2 action. So C3 can be regarded as a non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold. As a non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold, you don't necessarily expect it to have a fibration by T3s, and in fact, in this case, there turns out to be a fibration by T2 cross R, so generically by T2 cross R, and the description of that fibration is by means of a moment map for the T2 action, the U1 squared action, which is given by the first two terms here. You specify the specify values for the differences of the square lengths of the variables. And then a third function, which is used in addition to those two standard moment map functions, which is the imaginary part of the product of the variables being set equal to another constant. So that gives you a family of T2 cross Rs, which completely covers C3, and which, with respect to the flat metric on C3, actually are special Lagrangian subvarieties. So it's an extremely nice explicit description. The singular fibers here, by the way, the singularities in fibers, pardon me, are the coordinate axes. So indeed, transverse triple point is the right description of the singularities in this particular case. Joyce analyzed these a little bit further. So Joyce built a couple of closely related fibrations. The fibers in these fibrations are S1 cross R2 rather than T2 cross R. And these fibrations also come along with some disk instantons, that is, maps from the disk whose boundary lies in the singular locus, which have a non-trivial area. And you see a single disk instanton near A equals zero in this first family of examples that Gross discovered. Excuse me, Joyce discovered. And then Joyce gives a nice picture for how the disk instanton business is supposed to work. So as I drew, at least implicitly, a few moments ago, the image of S inside of B should be described as two real dimensional set inside that three dimensional parameter space, and it looks like a little strip. So that complicated thing on my graph can be kind of represented by some strip which is going to retract typically in some way, and then, as I indicated, it'll join up to other ones which typically will have the same kind of structure at these other kinds of vertices. So if you're right here in a neighborhood of one of these strips, that's where Joyce tells you something about what's going on. So he indicates that you'll have a single disk instanton you'll have a pair of disk instantons counting with opposite value as you cross the boundary of the strip. And then those disk instantons will sort of continue until you go to the other side, and you lose them at the other side. So there's a specific set of disk instantons associated to this picture. And that's actually extremely good for trying to understand how mirror symmetry could work with respect to a proposal like this. So I think one of the reasons that initially people had looked at a codimension 2 discriminant locus as being a reasonable thing to speculate about was that we needed a picture of mirror symmetry for this thing. So the mirror symmetry idea suggests that you had X over B and you had Y over its base. And in the most naive version, you're expecting to find these bases identified, and maybe you would hope to identify the base minus the discriminant locus. Well, certainly you're going to want to identify the base minus the discriminant locus, and then just take the fiber here and replace it by its dual fiber over here, and get this picture of T3 fibered spaces which are dual to each other. So topologically, this is not so hard to carry off, but the Calabi-Yau metric is actually being predicted here, according to the physics argument, in some form or another. And understanding how that Calabi-Yau metric would fit with a picture like this was pretty difficult if the image of the discriminant locus was dimension 2. In particular, we have to reconcile the fact that the discriminant locus here has some sort of structure which is sort of flat, and the discriminant locus over here has another structure which is standing vertically. This one's horizontal, standing vertically, and then having these other kinds of pieces come off in other directions. So clearly, the metric behavior of this family, together with the metric behavior of the whatever metrics are being described on the fibers of the bundle, differs between these pictures, and so it's hard to understand how you would make sense of mirror symmetry. But the solution is, and this goes back to the original paper, the solution is SYZ fibrations must be corrected by disk instantons, SYZ metrics, excuse me, must be corrected by disk instantons contributions. So that's something that's expected from the physics. Joyce's results point the way to where those disk instanton contributions are to be found. But I should point out that the calculation, it ought to be possible to explicitly calculate what this effect is, but the calculation has not been made. But there's at least room within this picture of a modification of the metrics on the total space by means exactly of these disk instantons, which are associated with wide parts of the discriminant locus, to sort of reconcile mirror symmetry with this picture. So the picture, in a way, doesn't look terribly mirror symmetric. Figure 2 in my green monster figures was supposed to be a figure that looks very similar to the one that's there, except that instead of building up all of the spaces out of sort of smooth guys as depicted in the figure that I showed you, it was going to build them up out of spheres like this with transverse triple points, and that's supposed to be the mirror of that figure, right? Sorry, I need transverse triple points everywhere, so I've got to have more spheres. But the mirror of the figure that I was giving you is supposed to be a rather different looking object, and in a way, without having codimension 2 singular sets, we seem to lose track of what mirror symmetry might be. Well, So the basic proposal is that the structure of S for generic fibrations is, as I proposed, that it should be in codimension 4 with only these transverse triple points. And that D retracts to a graph. And then there are all these monodromy properties about the graph. So I'd like to connect this now, if I can, to the Gross-Siebert approach, which I'm assuming there's been one talk about, and I guess there's going to be another talk about. I unfortunately didn't hear Mark's talk. So the Gross-Siebert approach to degenerating Calabi-Yaus and the connection goes like this. So in the Gross-Siebert approach, we look at families of Calabi-Yau manifolds. So now I have some space script X over a disk, and I can do the same sort of thing. I can look at the set of singular points in fibers, and I can look at the image of that, excuse me, So script X should also map to a family of bases, script B, and the image of that singular set should go to a set of discriminant curves inside of B. So here's my even bolder proposal. The proposals about the structure of S I don't consider to be terribly bold. They're a little bit novel because of the focus on S rather than B, but I think there's a lot of evidence to back them up, and I'll mention a little bit more of it a bit later. But an even bolder proposal is a connection to families like this. So in the bolder proposal, I suggest that there should exist a space, well, let's see how I want to say this. I have to say, I get a little confused trying to state this in the Gross-Seeberg context. I can do it better for hypersurfaces or complete intersections in toric varieties. But so my bolder proposal, well, my bolder proposal says that S looks like S of T looks like the intersection of X with some specific of XT with some specific subvariety of the total space. So let me call that sigma, where sigma in the total space is a sort of nice subvariety. And we should expect, in fact, X minus sigma should be fibered or should have an action by tori, which respects the fibration structure. Okay, I didn't say that very clearly, so let me do it again in the hypersurface or complete intersection case. It's easier to state in the hypersurface case. Complete intersection works exactly the same way. So in the familiar case of hypersurfaces and toric varieties, how does this work? We have a toric variety, which is the ambient space in which we wish to work, and we describe that toric variety as being the symplectic reduction, or GIT quotient, of Cn by some action of U1 to the n minus 3, n minus 4. So that gives us a four-dimensional toric variety. We have inside of V Calabi-Yau hypersurfaces, Xt, depending on the choice of polynomial somehow. These are Calabi-Yau. And we have a natural notion of a large complex structure limit, which is what's formalized in the Gross and Seibert constructions, large complex structure limit is described by the polynomial product of zi equals 0, where this ranges over all homogeneous coordinates. So V, of course, is covered by a bunch of charts. It makes sense to talk about the product of all the homogeneous coordinates in all of those charts, and that turns out to be an example of a Calabi-Yau manifold. So being near the large complex structure limit in this picture is usually taken to mean that you have a perturbation of this particular polynomial. So the singular set of, so this is x0. The singular set of x0 is then represented by the union of the sets where zi equals zj equals 0. You set two of these guys to 0 at a time. And here's my bold proposal for S. The bold proposal for S is that S, which is the set of singular, tori in an SYZ vibration on X sub T. S should be the singular locus of X0 intersected with X sub T. S sub T should be that. So let me repeat what I'm saying. So here's my conjecture. And let's just specialize to familiar cases like the quintic and the quintic mirror. But it works exactly the same way in other cases. The conjecture is that there exists a special Lagrangian torus vibration, which means singular fibers are allowed, on any quintic, respectively quintic mirror, sufficiently close to large complex structure. Whose singular points, whose singular set S, is exactly X intersected with the union of all the ZI equals ZJ equals 0. So I want to go back to my picture. So this picture wasn't random. My green monster, oops. So the picture wasn't random. This is actually the picture of the intersection of the quintic with z1 equals z2 equals 0. Well, it's a funny tinker toy model of such a thing. But it's got genus 6. You can see 6 holes. It's got 5 points of intersection with the edges. Yeah, I should have mentioned. So where are the transverse triple points? The transverse triple points happen are at X intersected with the various ZI equals ZJ equals ZK equals 0. So there are 5 homogeneous coordinates in this case. That means having specified 2 to give me this component, I've got 3 other ones. Those are the 3 edges of the triangle. And you see 5, well, some of them are in shadow because I haven't mastered lighting in this silly program. But you see 5 things along each of those edges. And each of those, along each of those 5, the surface joins on to 2 other surfaces. I was going to try to make all 10 surfaces show up, but it didn't work. I mean, if I'd had it, well, next time I give this talk, I'll have beautiful, much more beautiful graphics. So you've got this one here. Let me draw a picture. You've got a triangle here with this curvy thing, and it meets 5 points, and then it hits 2 other triangles, each one of which has another copy of the same thing, and so on and so on. So this intersection with these pairs actually retracts onto the familiar graph with largely negative vertices here and some positive vertices there, which is known to have the correct monodromy behavior for the Calabi-Yau. When you do the mirror, you're going to get a different picture. In the mirror case, when you do all these intersections, well, you discover that most of the components just turn into spheres. And these spheres are meeting along these transverse triple points. In fact, that one's a little easier to handle in a certain sense. There's this familiar graph which is used to describe the combinatorics of these models, which describes the blow-up that you need to do to create a resolution of the ambient space for the quintic mirror. And in this particular case, each of the toric P1s. So toric P1 is represented by a little interval in this graph joining barycenters of adjacent symplices. Each of those P1s, well, each P1 meets two other P1s. You see the transverse triple point structure right there. So although they're sort of on the face of it isn't, okay, my startup disk is almost full, sorry. Go back to that. On the face of it, there's a lot of asymmetry between those two graphs. They do retract onto the familiar graphs, which describe the discriminant loci. So I have to say, this I found this rather surprising that something so simple is true. And it's not just true for the quintic. I mean, it's a fundamental property of these complete intersection models that the topological structure of the fibrations, which was described in great detail through work of Gross, Ruan, Hasse, and Zarkov, is actually captured precisely by the structure of the intersection with this simple set, and the graph and the affine structure and so on works in exactly that way. Sorry, there was one other thing I meant to say when I was trying to do the Gross-Siebert version of this, which was I had X going to B, script B, and so which contains script D. And so what I think happens is that script D approaches script 0. This describes the retraction. So you'll see the retraction happen, and as Gross and Siebert have explained to us, we really do get a codimension 2 singular set once we've reached the limiting point in a family like this. Okay, so, well, I want to talk about one case where we have some detailed information about special Lagrangian subvarieties. So I already mentioned the Harvey-Lawson description for C3. So C3 is known to have this nice family of special Lagrangian subvarieties from the original work of Harvey and Lawson. More generally, if I have a toric Calabi-Yau manifold, this work of Goldstein, has a family of special Lagrangians that has a very similar structure. It's given again by means of some moment map in which essentially you have to take something like differences of homogeneous coordinates. What you're really doing is taking the moment map for the part of the torus action on the toric manifold which preserves the product of the homogeneous coordinates. And then you have this final imaginary part of Z1 up to Zn type thing. So the fibers of that map, again, give you a family of T2 cross Rs which fiber the thing. And when you apply this kind of formalism to those cases, well, it's a non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold, and so perhaps not surprisingly, you end up discovering a discriminant locus which has codimension 2 again, and in fact is a planar graph. I should have emphasized that the negative vertices in my nomenclature are planar. The positive vertices are definitely not planar. The image of any component of S is locally planar in the base B, but when you get to these transverse triple points, you start losing that planarity property. So you end up with some very beautiful structure of planar graphs. And in fact, this has shown up in another context, a somewhat related context, in physics in the last few years. And I'd just like to mention that and indicate how these ideas all fit together, and then I'll wrap it up. So I emphasized at the beginning that the local model for the singular points was supposed to be this codimension 4 point that you saw by studying an elliptic vibration on K3s. And in the case of the codimension 4 point, there is a U1 action in a neighborhood, some appropriate neighborhood. Well, if I can find, so if X is a local Calabi-Yau with a U1 squared action, there's a very pretty construction that you can do. From the physics point of view, you can use any of the U1s, can be used to relate the M theory on X to the type 2A on X mod U1. And in fact, if you look at effective nine-dimensional theories, you can really relate all of them at the same time to type 2A in nine dimensions on X mod U1 squared. So I'm allowing my U1 squared action to have fixed points. That's exactly what's happening in this large variety of examples, all toric Calabi-Yau manifolds, because they've got special Lagrangians. And it's actually a very nice class of examples because of it's one of the few cases where we actually have special Lagrangian metrics or special Lagrangian subvarieties with respect to a metric that we know. So, okay, so what does the string theorist do when they see this construction? Well, you use the so-called Aspinwall-Schwarz relationship. It's also the thing that's used to produce F theory, and you end up making a 2B model for the same guy. So what's going on when you've passed to this 2A theory in nine dimensions? Well, the various components of S are each going to have an associated vanishing cycle. And you can recognize those vanishing cycles by the monodromy behavior. So there's specific monodromy behavior near any of these cycles. And if you use the U1 action, which has the sub-U1 of U1 squared, which has a fixed point along that component, then you'll end up seeing D6 brains. And then when you reduce on the further U1, at least away from the transverse triple points, you'll still just see a wrapped D6 brain. Sorry, it may or may not be wrapped, depending on whether the other U1 is wrapped by it or not. So reduces to wrapped or unwrapped D6 in nine dimensions. And then when you dualize, you get a collection of D5 and D7 brains. So let me ignore the D7 brain possibility for a second. The D5 brain possibility is the one that's most familiar. And in this context, that's going to happen precisely when the discriminant is a planar graph. So you end up with what's called in physics this web of PQ5 brains. And the web of PQ5 brains is exactly produced by this simple construction from the known special Lagrangian vibrations on toric Calabi-Yau manifolds. The inverse image here, the set of singular points in fibers, is exactly the set of things which are defined by the vanishing of two of the homogeneous coordinates, as I mentioned before. And so that singular set has the same kind of description here in the toric Calabi-Yau manifolds as it did in the global case. So the extension to also including D7 brains gives us some beginnings of a physical description of the two different kinds of vertices. So we're mainly getting, through this D5 brain story, we're mainly getting the case of positive vertices. These are from the D5 brains. And the negative vertices can also correspond to D7 brains. But I should mention that it's not generally possible for a global Calabi-Yau manifold to find anything like a U1 squared action or even a remnant of it, because the monodromy globally is going to act non-trivially on the entire three torus. So finding an invariant T2 is something that you shouldn't expect, but you can at least model some pieces of a Calabi-Yau manifold with D5 brains and D7 brains. And then the other recent thing in physics which this is clearly connected to is the so-called topological vertex. So the topological vertex story is about open string theory on certain kinds of open Calabi-Yau manifolds, non-compact Calabi-Yau manifolds, including the cases I've just been discussing. And the brains defining the topological vertex open string theory models. So you take the open string on this space that has brains in it, those exactly correspond to the singular set in my formulation for some T3 vibration. Sorry, some special Lagrangian vibration. These are non-compact cases, so it's probably not T3, it's probably T2 cross R or something of that sort. So in principle, one could sort of piece together the topological vertex story. So the topological vertex story is typically about these cases with transverse triple points, right? But now you might have to link in to some other case where you've got to study some vertices that aren't these topological vertices, some other pieces of this singular set where you have to use slightly different techniques to handle them, but there are also techniques for studying open string theory there. And then you might get some back to some region where there were a bunch of topological vertices helping you understand the story. So if you set yourself the task of understanding open string theory on a Calabi-Yau manifold, open or closed, whose brains have been placed on the singular locus of T3 vibrations, you have a really good chance of being able to use the T3 vibration story in some way to help you with the topological vertex theory. And there's some work in progress ongoing about that. Well, I think I'll stop there and ask if there are any questions.
Are there any questions? Comment?
In this slide that's actually up there right now, where instanton corrections are being depicted, I'm just wondering, when you say that instanton corrections will correct the metric, do you have any idea at all how that could happen?
Well, when you write the metric on the moduli space of brains, it has a semi-classical term, which should come directly from the sort of geometric information that you have, right?
Something like the Buescher rules.
That's right. But then there's at least a formal sum over disk instanton corrections to that. Actually, not just disk instantons, arbitrary instanton corrections to such a metric, because we're discussing moduli of brains. And so you can write this down formally. In fact, you can find a sort of schematic version of the formula in the Strometry Alsasla paper. But and so what that means is that you'll have some way of describing the metric on the total space, which is a sort of classical term plus these correction terms.
And the corrections would actually be like symmetric two tensors or something that you
presumably
would have.
Yeah.
I thought there was no monodromy in the topological vertex. So maybe I don't understand.
So the monodromy that I have in mind is the monodromy on the T3s or the T2 cross R vibration. And there's certainly is monodromy around the if I regard this as a set S, there, and I sort of traverse a path around this guy and look at the behavior of the T3s or T2 cross Rs, then there's monodromy.
has a question.
Oh, just a naive question. So what's involved with passing from the form of your conjecture for hypersurfaces to complete intersections?
So in the hypersurface case, you have to decompose the coordinates into certain subsets. And the limit is an intersection of hypersurfaces, each of which is a product of some of the homogeneous coordinates. And I mean, that was how Batrev and Borisov formulated
the net partition.
Right. So now I've got a singular set, singular limiting set, and I just take the intersection with the singular points of the limiting set in the same way that I did here.
Other question?
So all these things, I guess implicitly, I should have mentioned that the there's this very beautiful structure, sort of geometric structure on the base, right, which seems that it's the structure you find when you pass to the limit. So when I got to the limiting B0, which contained B0, this conservative Seubelman business and the Gross and Siebert stuff tells you this affine structure there. And presumably what's happening is we're taking a limit which is approaching that affine structure as we go to t equals 0 in a family. Combinatorics should be the same throughout the family.
If not, so let's thank speaker again.